Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm very happy to have as my guest Ana Castillo, who has been on Bookworm before to the point that I consider her to be a friend, although we've spoken on the show only twice before. We've had long conversations. The new book is called The Guardians. It's published by Random House, and it's a very new book for Ana Castillo, whose work includes books of poetry, like My Father Was a Toltec, books of essays. She's published recently a novel in verse, Watercolor Women, Opaque Men. The last time we spoke to her, she had published a novel, Peel My Love Like an Onion. And this book strikes me as being a very different kind of book, because often her books are very poetic and involve artist figures. There's a kind of poetic impressionism that goes through the book. This is very much a sequential narrative, a real novel. And I wondered what led you to working really with the bones of the novel. What happens next?
Oh, well, it is an interesting observation, and not one that was completely coincidental for me. I actually did decide to not write about a creative person, as you say, which is always just one step away from being autobiographical to some degree, at least in terms of the people that you might know. My principal character in this new book is a teacher's aide. I myself have earned my livelihood off and on throughout my adulthood teaching adults. This woman doesn't ever quite make it through college. She is very proud of the fact that she's done what she has done, but she is a teacher's aide, and there's this level in this character's mind and heart of feeling that she can't quite get there, underestimating herself, if you will. So I wanted to put someone out there to the readers. About a character who is humble, but yet has enormous amount of potential, untapped potential. I think that's what I was striving for in this case.
She has constant projects. She's grown and sold vegetables. She's tried cooking pies with her mother. She's sold secondhand clothes, for which they'd spend an entire month ironing and sewing and cleaning, but gathering $20 for them, that got shelved. And, you know, there is a sense that she wants an education, but she remembers her mother saying, "We don't spend time in school, we work." And so there's a tug in her. And in that way, she's familiar from your other novels in that the flamenco dancer was lame. These women that you've written about are dealing with a built-in obstacle that they have to face. And in this case, this woman, her name is Regina, she's one of four narrators, she has a double obstacle. One of them comes from the fact that she is almost a figure of folklore that people don't believe in. A woman who, although she had been married, her husband went off just after the wedding day, so she is a virgin widow. And even the priest does not believe that this could be the fact about her. She has a nephew, she has family relationships, she's a passionate woman, and yet the figure, again, is of an incompletion in a certain sense that comes not from herself, but what others bring to her.
She's the only one, as you've mentioned, this other character in Peel My Love Like an Onion, who has what we would consider deficiencies. And she, but again, like in Carmen La Coja and Peel My Love Like an Onion, she's the only one who doesn't see that. she doesn't understand why anyone would think that to be a complete woman you have to give birth or that you have to, you know, have a man in your life. She doesn't see that being a teacher's aide is not enough. Other people say to her, why don't you go to back to school, Miss Regina? You'd make a great teacher. And she says, well, I don't know, maybe someday I will. I think that for myself, a goal has been, since I started writing very young and came out of a time in this country's history where we didn't have role models for women of color. We didn't have role models for poor women of color, and that's my own personal background. I think that it's been very important to present these obstacles that you say are these challenges and yet show the challenges that might be overcome, bring the reader on that journey, if you will, so that they're hoping, as we hope for Regina, let's say, that she will one day become a teacher, that she'll get together with this big hunk. That's one of the other narrators. He's got all this potential as a guy, and he's tall and strong and good-looking, and we're saying through the whole book, get together with him, and maybe they will get together. So we present these things and these challenges. As I think in our lives, we have them all the time in different ways, and we make choices every day as to whether that's an important way to go or not. Sometimes we wait a while, and she's in her 50s, and the other question here is it too late for her?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's also one of the many border crossings in the book between old and young. And in fact, we're presented in this book with the idea that unless enforced, borders are frequently merely illusions. The town in this book is divided between two states, but in fact, they're the same town. This is a town that straddles New Mexico and Texas. And, you know, they are traveling from town to town, but the significant border is between the U.S. and Mexico. And again, we see a border that is real and unreal. It's a border when it wants to be, when it is enforced. Workers are allowed over the border at any time until they're considered to be illegals, and suddenly the border is a different kind of border. And I think the book is all about the finding of borders and asking, how can we break them? How can an older woman stop saying, I'm an older woman, so I can't be with a younger man? The sense of scandal, of social scandal, very much a part of this. People know her. She has come from a background that has brought her to a certain place in her life, and she has to learn that she doesn't have to inhabit that place in her life. She needn't be a recluse anymore. In fact, life won't let her.
I found that transformation for her myself toward the end of the book, obviously, and we're hoping that she gets to that conclusion. It's sort of a subtext to the main story, because for her, survival is always first. So only toward the end does she ask questions such as, do I have room in my life for love? Personal love, personal fulfillment. And I think that that's a question that comes up in societies where we don't have things that many of us take for granted. Food on the table any given day. Our rent paid easily, you know, not worrying about it in the first of the month. We have, unfortunately, in this country that so many people love to say is the greatest country in the world and the most powerful and the richest country in the world, we have enclaves of communities, and particularly communities of color, in which people do have to grapple with that every single day. Once you get past that, once you aren't worried anymore about whether or not you'll have a roof over your head and whether your children will be fed, then we start to think about happiness. I'm concerned about bringing to life in literature people that when I was growing up, I couldn't find. And I felt that I loved literature. And as I got older and Toni Morrison's books came out, for example, you know, African-American literature in this country, because I was born and raised in this country, Then I felt like, okay, I'm getting close. But still, I didn't find someone that really acted like my mother, you know, may she rest in peace, or you know, the girls in my neighborhood. And so I felt it was my task, if you will, to then learn to write about them.
I want to talk to you really because it interests me about the double figure here of the Virgin, because, you know, so much cultural humiliation is brought to figures who are considered to be virginal by default, or who are told that they are not, could not be virginal. And yet, looming in the background always in your work is La Virgen, La Virgen de Guadalupe, and the obligation to believe in the story of the Virgin.
Well, I think that we pick up on the whole Virgin emphasis, at least in Mexican culture vis-a-vis Catholicism, where we become obsessed with that. From my understanding, because, you know, I write about mestizos and people of Mexican and Latino origin, so I'm also as interested in pre-Columbian beliefs and the pre-conquest of Mexico. And from my understanding, there was as the patriarchy got more militant and more powerful, and women's power in their societies goes down, there is more emphasis on virginity because, of course, the woman is now a possession, and we have to make sure that the heirs, the legacy, goes to the man, you know, the father, the man in question. So all that's tied into that, and it's so complex and it's so tied in. We don't even know where one thing begins and the other thing ends. I didn't really give Regina a whole lot of thought about that. I think what I was thinking about was I wanted this woman to be contained unto herself, that she is self-sufficient 100%, that there is no compromise for her in this culture as to doing something for her father or for her, you know, brothers. She does take this boy by default after he's lost his mother is when she starts taking on that role. But I think somewhere in my subconscious, this is really where I was going when I saw her as being the virgin widow, is her whole life has been just about survival.
And yet, in a certain sense, the characters in this book are all straddling a divide of this sort. Her nephew, her brother's child, much of the book is concerned with a search for this brother who has, one fears, disappeared either into the drug trade or been murdered by that traffic. The son, this boy, Gabo, is thinking about becoming a priest. The priest, on his part, has a longtime mistress, and he's thinking about leaving the priesthood. And so this question, and the man, the hunk you've spoken of, has an appearance in the book at a rodeo, but he's a teacher with a ponytail. When are you going to get rid of that? He has an ex-wife, but he lives alone in his trailer. He's drawn to the virgin widow, but thinks that, you know, they spend a good deal of the book in a conversation that can't address the idea that he is attracted to her. She can't accept it, and he can't state it. And so this question of virginity and life is dominant for many of the characters in the book.
Well, our boy, this wonderful boy who's loves to read and who wants to, this after he's, you know, met his family's obligations and perhaps go to college, he wants to give up all material things. He represents for me in this story, dividing myself up into these characters, he does represent that state of innocence and at least striving for it, if we can in life. At some point, something will take that away. His mother's murder probably damaged it to some degree. His father's disappearance is probably going to do and more. I don't want to give too much away from the story. But I think that for me, when I divide myself up, you know, like a split personality when I'm writing, I think that's where I was going with this boy. And I remember that part of myself pre-adolescence, when you do believe in goodness and you do believe that somehow you can give yourself over to the spiritual rather than the material. So that's who he is for me. And I think that his aunt, who is such a humble person, sees that in him. She draws from that, from him.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Ana Castillo, author most recently of The Guardians, published by Random House. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Ana Castillo about her novel, The Guardians. One of the reasons I'm so interested in this subject is that I know that you are the keeper of a shrine, and that in the role of patroness, or the person who keeps the threshold to the holy, that there's frequently a division between the physical and the spiritual. And I wondered in what way you feel that being an author is, in a sense, being at that other border, the one between the spiritual world and the physical world.
Well, I do live in this world. I feel like where I've chosen to live in the last few years is almost at the edge of the world. Sometimes I feel living in the desert, that it's like being in kind of a timeless place where I connect with my ancestors, where I can commute with a certain kind of nature that really must struggle to survive being in out in the desert as it is, and that is where I chose to build an adobe chapel. It's very zen. The only thing in there is that's iconic is a stained glass of Our Lady of Guadalupe. She has represented for me my whole life something much more cultural in some ways than spiritual. And then we question what is spiritual. If something nurtures you, if you can grow from that, then of course it is spiritual. It doesn't have to be defined by religion per se. And for me, I'm familiar with her since earliest memory in terms of relationship with the Mexican people, and in particular Mexican communities that have gone north. I believe very strongly that the way Jung saw the mother archetype, that the human beings look for that mother archetype. We need that symbol. If we didn't have her, we would invent her. I also see in the Our Lady of Guadalupe, I see her dressed up, but she is the pre-Columbian goddesses also. She appeared in the very same spot that the mother goddess used to be worshipped at in Mexico. You don't have to think too hard or too long about that, how that happened. And I also feel that out of respect for other religions and other beliefs, that she, by any other name, she is still our mother and the mother goddess.
What really interests me, as I'm trying to suggest, is that distinctions are made that vanish. If we talk about the fourth of the narrators, El Abuelo, Milton, he is a man who is blind and deaf, except he sees at night, and when Regina gives a shrill whistle, he jumps and she says, "I thought you were deaf." that in these books, okay, let's look at it really with clear eyes. We have three guardian figures: Regina, Miguel, who, as perhaps the suitor of Regina, is acting as a guardian to Cabo, to Gabriel, and the grandfather of Miguel, Milton, and they have all become guardians to a saintly boy who, whether we accept it or not, has bled from his palms in the course of preaching in a school cafeteria, and yet to others he looks like he sustained a football injury. That the question of rescue over a border is a question of the holy or the daily, and the saint and the boy who might become a member of a gang are the same person. And that's what I think is so interesting in this book and your books in general, that the world of distinctions is constantly being transcended or at least questioned.
On a personal level, I feel I've been asked about, in this book, about the various forms of spirituality that came out in this story. And again, I was working on developing a believable plot about this missing individual and again, the strong woman that's got all the challenges and bringing in complex and perhaps sympathetic male characters. And I wasn't very conscious of the different ways they manifest spirituality for themselves. But there were, once people started asking me in the last few weeks since the book came out, about that, I have to ask myself, where did this come from that I was talking about? You suggested Miguel's wife, he's divorced, she's a born-again Christian, and then Miguel himself does the sweat lodge. He does the Chicano thing out there with the guys. Regina could take it or leave it, but in her own life, I think she's a spiritual person. This boy wants to be a barefoot Franciscan monk. And then there's the priest who has his transformation and has to negotiate who he is. And I think for myself in the last years, I have grappled a great deal with my own heritage, my grandmother's legacy as a curandera, as a spiritual leader in my community, and as I grew up, and in my other teachers and so forth. It was very difficult, as it is for all of us, to always follow that path, to always know the right path and always do the right thing for all of us. And I'm sure I'm speaking for everyone. The Pope has to get up and pray every day for the same reasons. The Dalai Lama is also very humble about his awareness. And I think that's been my lesson in the last years, and that is that understanding our humanity is the spirituality. Understanding that we are here precisely because we don't have all the answers and we're trying to figure it out, and some days are better than other days. And this is what each of my characters goes through. Even this boy that you say, he wants to find his father. Once that gets done, he figures, you know, once he's 18, he'll go to college and be his aunt in that way. And then he'll go and he'll deny all material things and be this holy person. And yet, what path does he choose to do that but with the gangbangers that take him astray? And so he has that conflict immediately.
Well, that's what I love, that the same person who is contemplating living a life of a Franciscan in silence is, because of his silence, taken to be becoming one of those sullen, silent gang members. I took this again as a version of the book. The book could be a thriller if there were easy answers. But because there are not easy answers, because the characters are complex, they do the best they can, and when they stop, they stop. Their ending is tragic, but it's accepted as, to some extent, typical of life in this community. The novel isn't going to make itself into a shrine for the lost or for salvation. It has a doubleness so that everything in it is a part of life which is itself, if you'll pardon me, double, spiritual and real, poor but very capable, male and female with parts of each. And so, you know, the desire to make a thriller is to make something that has easy answers and easy divisions. And I think that what you've done instinctively is to say, to name something by a genre or to name a person as holy or gangbanger is to be false to the reality of a community.
Well, it's funny because I've always driven for creative literature and not written any particular genre. And I know that in the mystery, you always have a death or some mysterious disappearance in the beginning. And so there you set it up. And I realized that if I had wanted to, I could have written a mystery. And the whole mystery is around finding this particular character. But in a poor community in real life, that's only one of the many things, one of the many problems going on in each of these characters' lives. One, you know, your own existential angst on any given day, and then, like I said, trying to get food on the table, hoping that you don't lose your job when there are rumors going around that the funds are going to be cut off. And so that's where the story went instead of, as you say, that easy way. I realize in hearing responses from readers that it ended up being suspenseful and, as you say, it could have been a thriller. But then we're reminded that in communities that are abandoned or forgotten by this country or by this government or are neglected or despised, life will go on with more problems and with more joy and hope as the spirit, the human spirit will allow.
I've been speaking with Ana Castillo, author most recently of The Guardians, recently published by Random House. Thank you, Ana, for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.